in the matter of Dr. Dominic Lembo and Belmont Dental Associates versus Arlene Marchese. May we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Ms. Shattuck, please go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. First, I'd just like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal in the event that it's necessary.
We'll have you back, perhaps for a little less than that.
Thank you. Your Honors, there is nothing out of the ordinary about this case involving a forged endorsement claim against a depository bank. It is a run-of-the-mill, crooked bookkeeper case under New Jersey's Uniform Commercial Code. Plaintiffs had a claim under the UCC, but it was time-barred. Yet we are here today because the appellate division erred by allowing that same claim expressly governed by and barred by the UCC to be brought under New Jersey's Uniform Fiduciaries Law. No such affirmative claim exists under the UFL, a statute intended to protect banks. The appellate division erred by determining that an employee who wrongfully obtains a check without any authority is a fiduciary under the UFL. Now, this case deals with the intersection of the UCC and other laws. But to be clear here, plaintiffs had a claim under the UCC, and that claim was time-barred. There is no dispute. There have been other cases brought before this court and the appellate division, and time again, the courts have ruled that absent a special relationship, which is undisputably not present here, the UCC's framework exclusively allocates and apportions the risk of handling checks, and that courts should be hesitant to improvise new remedies outside the already intricate scheme of Articles 3 and 4. Now, in both city check cashing and ADS, this court found nothing factually unique to allow a claim to proceed outside of the UCC and that no purpose would be served by departing from the UCC's provisions. In ADS, this court did not permit a claim, even where the plaintiff argued that the UCC did not provide an adequate remedy. Here, plaintiffs were provided a remedy. However, they failed to bring a timely claim. The appellate division's decision permitting an otherwise barred claim to survive overrides the express proclamation of this court and the legislator that the UCC, which was designed to bring uniformity to commercial transactions, provides the sole remedies on a claim of a forged endorsement. Allowing a UFL claim here is in direct conflict with the UCC, as was the case in the state of Paley, where the appellate division refused to permit a CFA claim in conflict with the UCC. Without reversal, banks in this state will be subjected to limitless claims otherwise barred by the UCC. Now, in addressing the appellate division's blatant errors, it's important to note what is not in dispute here. First, plaintiff's employees were without any authority to deposit the checks at the bank. Second, plaintiff's claim against the bank is governed by the UCC, which provides a remedy for conversion of a check by paying on a forged endorsement. Third, any UCC claim here is barred by the 3-year statute of limitations. Lastly, there is not a single allegation of a special relationship with the bank, and permitting a common law claim here would thwart the purposes of the UCC. Now, despite those undisputed issues, the appellate division, in a complete turnaround, after first noting that the complaint makes no reference to the UFL, permits plaintiffs to amend their complaint to bring the same claim expressly governed and barred by the UCC under the UFL. By doing so, The appellate division completely ignores its own analysis, the directive of this court and the legislator that the UCC governs the forged endorsement claim at issue here. The UFL was intended to protect banks from monitoring a fiduciary's use of funds entrusted to him for a proper purpose. The UFL does not provide an affirmative claim based on a forged endorsement. The UCC does. More to the point, the UFL does not insulate a bank from liability just because the depositor or endorser also happens to be a fiduciary. In both the cases of Leeds and Salzman, the plaintiff's attorney forged checks and the depository bank sought to use the UFL as a defense to a conversion claim. The courts found the plain language of the UFL only applies to checks endorsed by a fiduciary if he is empowered to endorse such checks. Thus, regardless of any fiduciary relationship, a forger cannot be a fiduciary under the UFL. Now, in refusing to apply the UFL as a sword to supersede the liability imposed by the UCC, the Leeds Court found no policy reason for accepting such a broad interpretation of the UFL and every public policy reason for rejecting it. Here, there is no dispute. Plaintiff's employees did not have authority to negotiate the checks at issue. So if the attorneys who forged checks in both Leeds and Salzman were not fiduciaries under the UFL, certainly the employees here, without any authority, cannot be fiduciaries under the UFL. Now, if we were to accept plaintiff's belated argument that their employees are, I quote, constructive trustees under the UFL, it would strain the definition and allow any person who wrongfully takes a check to bring a claim under the UFL. So in sum, the appellate division's decision here allows the UFL to supersede the UCC. It provides for an affirmative claim by a forger without providing the bank any of the defenses available to it under the UCC. Most importantly here, the statute of limitations. If this court permits the appellate division's decision to stand, it effectively is overruling city cash checking and its progeny, and allowing for an ordinary conversion claim on a forged endorsement to be maintained outside of the UCC. Accordingly, reversal is necessary to prevent the upheaval of the UCC's comprehensive framework and the uniformity and predictability that it was intended to provide in commercial transactions.
I know you're arguing that the UFL doesn't provide its own cause of action. Assume it does for just a moment. Is it based on conversion? And if not, how does it conflict and upend the UCC?
If the UFL did provide for an affirmative cause of action, the point here is that it would not apply to the situation at hand, because as Leeds and Salzman both make plain, where a bank tried to use the UFL as a shield in light of the UCC conversion claim, the court said a forger cannot be a fiduciary under the statute. The statute goes directly to whether a fiduciary improperly used funds entrusted to him.
So you're not relying on the UCC as an impediment to the action going forward in your response?
Well, the UCC would be in direct conflict because the UCC provides for a forged endorsement claim against a bank. If you were to permit an affirmative claim under the UFL where someone has no authority to take the checks at issue, you would be then allowing two claims to proceed under the same statute, yet the UCC provides protections to a bank. It appropriately allocates and apportions the risk. The UFL, then what are the protections to the bank? Obviously not the statute of limitations.
Well, what is there anything in the UFL that suggests that the legislature intended an original claim to spring from it? And if that were the case, like what is the statute of limitations for a UFL claim if it exists?
Exactly. That's to my point, Your Honor. There is no statute of limitations listed. There are no affirmative elements. There are no defenses.
The UFL was created in 1927. I think that was before the UCC. Okay, but there were contract claims and fraud claims. And it seems to me, and you tell me if I'm mistaken, that it was intended as a defense for banks against conversion claims and fraud claims, is creating a high bar. And at least for fraud claims and conversion claims back then, they had statute of limitations. Go ahead.
Yes, the UFL was created to protect banks from having to monitor a fiduciary's use of funds. So if a fiduciary came to a bank, and the one case where the UFL did apply and this court looked at in the New Jersey title insurance case, there an attorney took funds from his attorney trust account and used them for gambling. He had the authority to take those funds, and the question was whether the bank should have had to inquire as to the attorney, what are you doing with these funds? The UFL was created to prevent banks, except in situations of bad faith, from having to say, attorney, what are you doing with those funds after you take them? That is not the issue
that is happening
in this court.
If this is obviously a UCC claim is not being brought here because we have a 3-year statute of limitations. Do you know what the statute of limitations is for common law conversion or for fraud?
Six
years.
I believe, Your Honor.
Okay. Assuming that the UFL does not give rise to a separate cause of action, then the plaintiff has to be proceeding under a 6-year statute of limitations for common law conversion.
Right, but the problem is, Your Honor, he cannot bring a common law conversion claim, as the appellate division aptly found here, because the UCC bars common law conversion claims absent a special relationship. And there's no dispute here. Plaintiff has never once said that there was a special relationship that would give rise to a claim outside of the UCC. So if you can't have a UCC claim, you can't have a common law conversion claim, you can't have a common law negligence claim, why would we permit an affirmative claim under the UFL, a statute that was intended to protect banks, and now you would allow a claim under that, and the bank has no protection?
This would have been an easy case had plaintiff filed within the 3-year statute of limitations, correct?
Yes, there would have been a remedy, and then we would have been much further down the line in the case. There are protections afforded to banks.
Do you agree that had the claim been filed within the 3 years based upon forged endorsements that the bank would have been liable?
Whether the bank would liable would depend on the factual circumstance, but yes, there would certainly have been a claim. We would have not prevailed on a motion to dismiss. We wouldn't be sitting here.
You've conceded that there were forged endorsements. Wouldn't the bank be responsible?
I conceded there are forged endorsements because I'm accepting all of the allegations as the complaint. Right. True. But yes, a bank is liable for a forged endorsement. Absolutely. So there would be no dispute. We would have not succeeded on a motion to dismiss.
So as you look at the plain language of Section 58 of the UFL, if a bank takes the check, receives the deposit, or pays it with actual knowledge that a fiduciary is committing a breach, or with knowledge of facts that paying the check amounts to bad faith, no liability?
Without knowing, yes, no liability.
No liability if the bank does those things.
In this instance, if the bank takes a check and has knowledge that a fiduciary is improperly using funds, is that what you're asking, Your Honor?
Yes.
The bank would not be able to use the UFL as a defense to liability on a conversion or misappropriation or some sort of breach of fiduciary claim.
So if I understand your argument, you've been quite plain, no cause of action whatsoever under the UFL.
There's no cause of action under the UFL.
And then in light of that, explain what it means when the second sentence of Section A says the bank, if it does certain things, would not be liable unless one or two.
The bank would not be liable on a breach of fiduciary claim or a negligence claim or a conversion claim. There could be a whole host of claims that one could bring against a bank when there's a breach of fiduciary duty.
But it could not bring a claim based on the express language in the second sentence of Section A, is your position?
Yes, you could not bring a claim. It's provided an affirmative defense to other claims such that arise out of a fiduciary relationship.
It was upping the game because banks are entitled to rely upon a fiduciary's good faith.
Yes.
And the question was, how closely were banks required to monitor fiduciaries?
Well, right. If a bank was going to ask every fiduciary that walked in and said, what are you going to do with these funds after I leave the bank? Banks couldn't possibly do that. Instead, the onus is on the principal to hire a fiduciary or empower a fiduciary and there to supervise them, not for the bank to supervise what the fiduciary is doing, except, for instance, in the title insurance case where there was a question of fact about bad faith. Did the bank have knowledge there that the attorney was gambling away the funds? They might have. They remanded it to the trial court to look into that. But that was also being used as a defense by a bank, saying, I don't have to monitor funds, and there the bank, maybe they should have, because they had some knowledge.
Doesn't that underscore the difficulty of applying the UFL in this situation under a constructive trust theory? Because the constructive trust theory doesn't even come into play until the funds are deposited. And yet we're suggest the theory of the case is that the bank had some obligation to act to prevent plaintiffs from even depositing these checks in accounts in their own name.
Yes, absolutely, 100%. A constructive trust happened after the fact. The bank's liability here is for taking the checks with a forged endorsement, mm-hmm. not supervising later on. So that's why that's a UCC claim.
Right.
The two statutes are at odds with one another if you allow both of them to run its course together.
Right.
And they provide, it totally casts aside the UCC where the legislator has tried to allocate an apportion. Where is the risk? What does the bank have to do? What does the customer have to do? And now you're adding another layer and saying, after the fact, when a constructive trust, maybe if that's their theory, is created, the bank was somehow supposed to supervise that.
It doesn't make sense to impose a responsibility after the fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Tell me if I'm mistaken. A constructive trust would only apply against the manager and the hygienist if their money were in their accounts. The constructive trust would basically be to seize the monies that were there. That would be the use of a constructive trust.
Yes, Your Honor. And let's keep in mind, they were sued in this action. A judgment was obtained against them. So they might be at fault for what happened, but that's a totally different inquiry than against a bank for a forged endorsement. And that's why Leeds and Salzman both say the act of liability on the bank is for taking a check with a forged endorsement, not for supervising a fiduciary's funds mm-hmm. and use of funds later on, whether they're fiduciaries mm-hmm. or not. There's no question here. They were without authority to take the checks. They cannot be fiduciaries under the statute.
Are both the office manager and the dental hygienist to be treated the same in the analysis of whether they're fiduciaries? Does the office manager have responsibility for handling or overseeing the handling of checks?
It doesn't matter. They're both to be treated exactly the same because in this instance, plaintiff has pled that they were without authority to accept checks. So even in the cases of Leeds and Salzman, they were attorneys. They had a fiduciary obligation, but they weren't acting in their fiduciary capacity. So that's what the court said is don't look at whether they are traditional fiduciaries. Look at what were they doing with the checks. They had no authority. So yeah, whether it was a bookkeeper, the hygienist, the janitor, it doesn't matter because plaintiff has pled that they were without authority.
So it goes past apparent authority as a question and founders on the scope of responsibility, scope of authority issued by Dr. Lembo.
Yes, and because here there's no factual issue. There is no issue. They were without authority. Mm-hmm. So you could call them, they could have been attorneys, they could have been trustees, they could have been whatever, and been fiduciaries in the traditional sense of fiduciary, but they had no authority. Leeds makes plain, and Leeds quotes, a forger cannot be a fiduciary under the UFL. It would not make sense in the way the statute was intended to be applied.
The dentist did not have a bank account at TD Bank.
No, the dentist was a non-customer of the bank. And that's why there were no allegations of a special relationship. The bank never had contact with the dentist.
Is there anything in the record to indicate that the officer manager was assigned the task of cashing checks for the dental practice?
No, there's nothing in the record, Your Honor. They repeatedly said they were without authority. They were without authority to take the checks and to endorse the checks.
Thank you.
Is there anything in the record about the office manager's relationship to the handling of checks altogether?
There is nothing in the record, Your Honor.
So there is no agency relationship here?
No.
Claimed or in fact?
Your Honors, this is based on the facts as pled in the complaint, which obviously now, even if we amend, cannot be contradictory. So
there's no mention of
there's
term
no
fiduciary.
Mention of it, and they have repeatedly said in everything before the court and in the complaint that they were without authority. They had no authority.
The term fiduciary is not mentioned in the complaint, is it?
No, and the appellate division notes that, as does the trial court in refusing to allow a UFL claim, that there's no mention of the term fiduciary in the complaint. The fiduciary UFL claim, the idea of it didn't arise until we were arguing before the trial court. There's no mention of it in the complaint.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to present?
No, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. DeMarco.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. May it please the court. And if I may, I will touch upon the points that were raised by counsel. And the first one being the issue as to whether or not the UFL creates a separate cause of action or is only a defense as suggested by the bank. Chief Justice Ravner, I would agree with your point that the plain language of the statute after the word unless does clearly provide that there would be liability.
My point was a question.
The question that you asked, I guess, would have been my point with respect to the plain language of the statute, that it does provide for liability. And not only do we have to rely upon the plain language of the statute, but we have this very court's 2000 holding in the matter of New Jersey Title Insurance versus Caputo, which was mentioned by counsel in passing, but not fully distinguished. And while the nature of the fiduciary relationship in Caputo is admittedly different, I think it's very important for this particular matter for a few reasons. And the first one is that the very claim of the title insurance company against the bank in Caputo was based upon not the UCC, but it was based upon a violation or an alleged violation of the UFL. So the very cause of action that this court dealt with in Caputo was, did the bank violate the UFL so as to give rise to liability for the bank to reimburse the title company for the money that it had paid to satisfy the mortgage that was, in fact, taken by Mr. Caputo. So not only the plain language of the statute, but this court's very holding in Caputo confirms that the UFL is not merely a defense, but provides for a separate and distinct cause of action. In fact, not only did this court find in Caputo that such a cause of action exists, but it went on to find that the trial court erred in granting the bank summary judgment on that cause of action. So from our perspective, the fact that a cause of action exists under the UFL is clear. The next issue that the bank raises is, well,
Are you representing that in Caputo there actually was a pled statutory UFL claim as opposed to a breach of fiduciary responsibilities that was not barred from liability under the UFL? Because I'm looking at Caputo now, and it's unclear to me.
Right. So I'm reading from Caputo, and essentially in the synopsis, a title insurance company, which had paid mortgages, brought an action against the bank to recover for violation of the Uniform Fiduciaries Law by permitting an attorney to withdraw funds in cash and certified check payable to himself from his attorney trust account. So my interpretation of that is that without having seen the complaint, Justice Levecchi, I don't want to represent, but my interpretation of the language of this court's holding is that the theory of recovery asserted by the title insurance company was in fact a violation of the UFL. And then further on in the case, specifically, at page 155, starting at head note 4, this court held, because of the nature of this standard, each case will necessarily be fact sensitive. whether in light of the foregoing, the bank acted in bad faith. This is my language now, which is the standard set forth, obviously, in the UFL, in continuing to honor Caputo's trust account checks is not a matter we decide, nor should the trial court have done so on the motion for summary judgment. The test for good or bad faith, under the UFL, my language, is a subjective one to be determined by the trier of fact unless only one inference from the evidence is possible. So the trial court obviously had granted the motion for summary judgment, and what this court found under Caputo was that under a cause of action under the UFL, and once we get by the fiduciary issue, okay, then we have to deal with, did the bank have actual knowledge, or did they have knowledge, or were there facts to demonstrate that there was bad faith? That portion of the analysis was fact-sensitive, has to be judged on the merits of the facts of each case, and is a jury question or a question for the trier of fact, not one to be decided by summary judgment.
Do you have any case other than Caputo that talks about UFL being a statutory cause of action as opposed to an explanation of immunity from liability that might otherwise attach?
Caputo was the only case that my research revealed mm-hmm. where there was an affirmative cause of action.
So,
I'm sorry.
What was the statute of limitation? If this was an independent cause of action, tell me what the statute of limitations is.
I would agree with counsel that it would be 6 years.
Based on what?
It's a common law tort theory. And
you're saying it's a statutory cause of action?
It's a tort theory under the UFL, and my understanding we didn't brief what the statute of limitations would be, but my understanding is we referred to Title 2A when a statute does not set forth a statute of limitations, and a 6-year statute of limitations. The statute of limitations, in my view, does not look at the theory of liability, but looks at the harm that was occasioned. And if it was a personal injury claim, it would be 2 years. And if it was a financial claim, a financial injury, it would be 6 years, unless there's another statute to the contrary.
Explain this to me, because I'm trying to understand this. In 1927, the legislature enacts the UFL to make it more difficult to sue banks in cases involving fiduciaries, basically upping the game. At that time, there are common law conversion, common law fraud, negligence actions, all of which could be brought against the bank. And it seems to me that the legislature was attempting to increase the standards for those causes of action by creating this standard of knowledge or willful blindness in the same way, and it's a little bit off, in New York Times versus Sullivan, where the United States Supreme Court, in a defamation action, decides to increase the protection to newspapers by requiring that they know about the falsehood or act in reckless disregard. It seems to me that this statute is acting the same way. Why am I mistaken?
Well, you may not be mistaken, but I don't think that the reasoning bars my client's claim because, again, first, it does provide for liability when there's a fiduciary with actual knowledge or there are facts demonstrating bad faith. So there is a heightened standard, and I think that's what separates a claim under the UFL from the UCC, and that's why the UCC does not govern this claim because they don't, and contrary to the bank's position, it's not the same claim. They're very separate and distinct and different claims. A claim under the UCC would apply if there were a single check with a forged signature and there would be strict liability.
You have that. And in fact, the reason why we're here is because the plaintiff did not file within
Correct.
The 3 years. Had a clear case of forged endorsements that were given to TD Bank, and had there been a suit within the 3 years, you'd be home free, correct?
I would agree with that assertion. And unfortunately, the discovery rule does not apply to UCC claims to toll the running of that statute. Okay. Now, with that being said, the UFL covers a distinct claim, and while there may be some overlap, okay, you can't say that these are the same claims. They're different, okay? Because under the UCC, all we would have to demonstrate, and we would be home free, because all we would have to do is demonstrate that a check was tendered by Ms. Marchese or by Ms. Wright with a forged signature, and there's strict liability, okay? Unfortunately, that's not the situation that we're in, and that's why we're here, okay? But with that being said, the UFL goes beyond that. Okay? The UFL wouldn't apply to a single check. Okay? And I think this court's holding in Caputo, okay, and the way it concludes its analysis of the UFL claim there is very important. This court stated at page 157, "We do not suggest that every instance of an improper withdrawal will trigger a finding of bad faith or a duty to investigate on the part of the bank. Without more, it seems unlikely that a single transaction or even a few isolated transactions would be sufficient to defeat the bank's motion for summary judgment. However, a reasonable jury could hold the bank accountable from the time it closed Caputo's business account or earlier, based upon the facts developed at trial. Our holding today is based on the cumulative facts contained in the record. Future cases will be similarly decided on their particular facts in keeping with the standard announced here." So
do you have a claim if Marchese and Wright are not fiduciaries? Do you have a claim?
No.
What is the evidence that they were acting in a role as a fiduciary?
Okay. So right now, there is no record because our complaint was dismissed in lieu of an answer. So there
was
no record.
What's the allegation in the complaint?
So what we claim here is that the bank...
What's in the complaint?
Right. So as the appellate division noted, the complaint doesn't allege fiduciary, but found that we should be permitted to amend the complaint to allege that because the facts, when viewed in the light most favorable to us, suggest such a cause of action.
Tell us how you would amend as to the dental hygienist. Start there.
Okay. So with respect to the dental hygienist, we would rely, first of all, on the portion of the UFL. Okay? And the resulting or constructive trust obviously wasn't something that we made up. That's in section 53.
How is a dental hygienist a fiduciary as relates to the handling of checks?
Okay. So the dental hygienist would become a resulting or constructive fiduciary or trustee. That's how it would be pled. What we would rely upon, the UFL defines fiduciary as, among other things, a resulting or constructive trustee.
So if that approach were to prevail, then virtually any employee could fall as a fiduciary under this statute, no?
If there were a employee who, and in this regard, I'm going to rely upon the definition of constructive trustee that this court set forth in Diapolito, and that was the reason why we relied upon Diapolito in our papers, not for the similarity of the cases, but because that was this court's definition of constructive trustee, because the UFL doesn't define constructive trustee. Okay.
Respectfully, though, I'm having trouble following your line of reasoning because your argument in making the hygienist in this situation a fiduciary has to overcome the fact that she's forging a check, engaging in a wrongful act, depositing it, and as a result of that wrongful chain of events, suddenly becomes a fiduciary of the victim. How can that be?
Okay. So, if I can, let me start with what we believe the definition of a constructive trustee is. And again, we're relying upon this court's holding in Diapolito, where it said that a constructive trust or a constructive trustee is where, number one, there is a wrongful act And that, number two, a resulting transfer of property that creates an unjust enrichment on the part of the recipient.
So you've read that correctly. It's in Thompson versus City of Atlantic. Yeah. A constructive trust is created out of our doctrine in equity. The conscience of equity is expressed in that. We want to make certain that someone who commits a wrongful act in acquiring money doesn't get away with it. If there were to be a constructive trust in this case, it would be imposed on the hygienist and the manager so that they weren't able to get away with the loot. I don't know how a constructive trust applies to the bank. Explain that to me.
Well, the constructive trust doesn't apply to the bank, okay? Here, it's alleged that the fiduciaries are Marchese and Wright.
There's a difference between a constructive trust and a fiduciary. A constructive trust is something we create out of equity to make certain that a wrongdoer doesn't get off with money to which the wrongdoer isn't entitled. What does it have to do with someone who is named as a fiduciary?
Well, Justice Alvin, in Section 3B, colon 14-53, subsection B, the legislature defined fiduciary. Who would be a fiduciary subject to the provisions of the UFL? And the legislature says a fiduciary includes a trustee under any trust, express or implied, or resulting or constructive. So that's the language of the legislature.
But it's happening after the act, after this party has engaged with the bank, and the bank is supposed to, after the fact, now regard this individual as a fiduciary? Time-wise, it doesn't make sense.
Well, and Justice Levecchi, I heard Your Honor's comment to counsel, and I thought about that, so I had some time to think, so I cheated. But Your Honor's hypothetical to counsel was that Ms. Marchese or Ms. Wright wouldn't be unjustly enriched to satisfy the second. The wrongful act is clear. They took a check from Dr. Mm-hmm. Lembo and they endorsed his name,
right.
And then they presented it. So the wrongful act is there. The next prong to satisfy a constructive trust is that there was a resulting transfer of property.
So that has to be deposited.
Right. So that would occur after the fact.
Right.
Now, that's why I believe the quoted section of Caputo that I quoted before from 157 is so important to our case. Because in the event it happened once, maybe twice, okay, the bank wouldn't have an obligation unless the teller was aiding and abetted and actively knew and was involved with Ms. Marchese and Ms. Wright. We don't know if that's the case.
The bank doesn't know TD Bank. Right? The TD Bank doesn't know, I'm sorry, your client, right?
Right.
Dr. Lembo doesn't have any account there.
Correct. But they know Ms. Marchese and Ms. Wright because they have accounts there. And what happened here, Justice Levecchi, is that it wasn't Ms. Marchese.
And they're not attorneys like Caputo was, creating a trust account in the bank, so the bank had some knowledge that they were dealing with a trust account. These were personal accounts held by the hygienist and the office manager.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But this isn't a situation where Ms. Marchese and Ms. Wright going to the bank one time with a check made payable to Dr. Dominic Lembo, and it's endorsed and they put it into their personal account.
Are you suggesting that the bank has a duty on these situations to make sure that the endorsee has allowed the endorsement? So they had a duty to check with Dr. Lembo to see if it was okay for them to do that? Is that your suggestion on every transaction in every bank when someone comes in with a check that's been endorsed by someone else?
My suggestion wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. However, what my argument would be is that once this happens four times, five times, six times, in this particular case, again, no discovery has been conducted, but hundreds of times, okay, to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, where you have Ms. Wright and Ms. Marchese coming into the bank branch, the same branch in Haledon where they maintain their accounts, hundreds of times with checks payable to either Dr. Dominic Lembo or Belmont Dental, and depositing it into their personal account. Okay. Now, there was no discovery in this case.
Would that apply if it was only one check, but it was a large check, small checks, but 100? Where do you draw the line? You're making the bank the insurer of your client.
That's
which is not what the UFL requires.
Right. Well, under Caputo, it's a jury question. It's fact sensitive on each case. In my opinion, if it were one check,
what is the fact question?
I'm sorry?
What is the fact question for a jury?
The factual question for a jury.
Because what you're stating is a maxim of law, which juries don't. The judge finds the law and applies the law.
Right. So
provides the law for the jury. You're suggesting that it's a fact question. Why would the fact question that the jury have to decide to cause create liability here? How many times? The size of the checks? I don't understand what you say the jury should find.
Okay. So Under your Honor's hypothetical, we would have gotten past the fiduciary issue, and now the question would be, did the bank have actual knowledge that the fiduciary was breaching his or her trust, or were there facts to suggest bad faith?
Under my analysis, you don't get past the fiduciary, but go ahead.
Well, but just the hypothetical that you had just posed to me, I was trying to answer, and it says, in dealing with the second prong, the bad faith standard, because the nature of this standard, and this is after this court defined, okay, what bad faith is. Okay, it stated, we hold that bad faith denotes a reckless disregard or purposeful obliviousness of the known facts suggesting impropriety by the fiduciary. It's not established by negligent or careless conduct or by vague suspicion. Likewise, actual knowledge of and complicity in the fiduciary's misdeeds is not required. Where the facts suggest fiduciary misconduct are compelling and obvious, it is bad faith to remain passive and not inquire further because such inaction amounts to deliberate desire to evade knowledge.
Can I stop you there for 1 second? I just want to come back to what the chief asked you. When did these employees, the office manager and hygienist, become trustees of this constructive trust?
Once the first check was deposited that they wrongfully took and deposited it into their own account and became unjustly enriched.
But the trust isn't created until the deposit.
Correct.
Coming back to what Justice Slovecki says.
Correct.
If it's created, it's after the deposit.
After the first deposit.
After the first deposit. They weren't fiduciaries, constructive or otherwise, at that point in time.
I would agree with Your Honor that once they became constructive trustees.
Well, they weren't. They weren't. They weren't until the funds were deposited in an account belonging to them.
Right.
They, as the wrongdoer, having forged the signature to get it into the account. So until that happens, their wrongful act and the deposit, they are not fiduciaries.
I would agree with that.
How did they come under the UFL?
Okay.
They would have had to be constructive. They would have to be constructive trustees before they deposited the money.
Okay. So, and right. I would agree with Your Honor that they do not become constructive trustees until that first check is wrongfully.
If they do, it's not until it goes in the account.
Right into the account. Now that that first check has gone into the account and they qualify, for argument's sake, as a constructive trustee. If it were just one check, as I said before, I don't believe there would be liability under the UFL, okay, given this court's holding that an isolated transaction wouldn't create liability.
But you're suggesting now that each time they do it, they are now allegedly constructive trustees of funds in an account belonging to them where they have supplemented it by forgery.
Correct.
In other words, the bank sitting there with their funds adds to their funds, and they are now constructive trustees of the funds in that account by virtue of their forgery.
By virtue of their forgery, they are now constructive trustees for the benefit of Dr. Lembo or Belmont Dental because they are holding funds that they obtained wrongfully that belonged to Dr. Lembo.
Isn't it better to say they weren't constructive trustees the first time, But if you're right, maybe it's the second, third, fourth, or fifth time when under the UFL, if there is a claim, the act of the bank in accepting the check is deemed to be gross neglect, is almost akin to fraud.
My position, Your Honor, would be a hybrid of those two situations. Okay, I believe they become a constructive trustee after the first check. I don't believe that there's liability on the part of the bank.
Constructive trustee. Who's the constructive trustee, the bank or the employee?
The employee.
Where is the race now? The race.
Today?
Yeah. I guess that money flew out of those bank accounts. Okay.
We wish we knew.
So the constructive trust is zero, the zero amount in that constructive trust right now.
Right. Probably.
So tell me if I'm mistaken. Typically, when a constructive trust is imposed under our doctrine of equity, it is to preserve money that already exists somewhere. Am I correct about that?
Yes, Your Honor. If you are seeking to impose a constructive trust against something, a constructive trust against money, against real estate, it's to preserve the asset. Here, the theory of constructive trust is being advanced to bring Ms. Marchese and Ms. Wright into the purview of the UFL because they are fiduciaries, okay, by virtue of being or having created a constructive
okay,
trust.
So I want to ask you a question about your sixth count, because that's the one against the bank, right?
Okay.
Doesn't mention the UFL, doesn't mention fiduciary. So I want to know, what did you have in mind as a cause of action for the sixth count when you drafted this complaint?
You're probably going to laugh, Your Honor, but exactly this situation, that's why we utilize the
no,
language.
No, did you have in mind a common law claim of conversion or fraud?
Not against the bank. Against Ms. Marchese and Ms. Wright, absolutely, but not against the bank. The UFL is what gives rise to liability against the bank. And
so you're saying, although you didn't mention the UFL, and although you didn't mention fiduciary, you actually had in mind the UFL as a singular cause of action in the sixth count?
We utilize the language that the bank aided and abetted Ms. Marchese and Ms. Wright.
Well, that would make them aiders and abettors in fraud. That's a common law cause of action.
Well, that's the language that the court uses in terms of UFL liability. Because, again, unlike the UCC, it's not a strict liability claim. It requires some involvement of the bank. Now, the question becomes: does the involvement of the bank, does it come from direct knowledge of the teller or someone else at the bank, or does it involve a willful blindness to the facts of the case? Now here, we were unable to conduct any discovery, as the court knows. Okay? So I couldn't tell Your Honors today whether this was the same teller that addressed the hundreds of checks presented.
I don't mean to interrupt you. I get where you're going.
Yeah.
Can I bring you back to the Chief's question, though? Doesn't Lead say, it's actually an inverse case. It applies to, can the UFL be a defense to the bank? But it essentially says that the forger of the instrument can't be the fiduciary.
Well,
doesn't it essentially say what you're saying happened, that the check was forged by the employee and deposit, creating a constructive trust? Lead says that can't happen when there's a forgery by the fiduciary.
Well, again, Leeds didn't involve the facts.
No, but it said the forger is not the fiduciary.
Well, under those facts, it wasn't.
It didn't say that. It said the forger is not the fiduciary. I understand it was being asserted as a defense, the UFL, by the bank to the claim. And the court said, no, you can't make that claim that they are fiduciaries because they forged the instrument. I thought that's what it said. I could be wrong.
Well, yeah,
I've been wrong before.
perhaps I'm confused because the setting was different, and as you already said, it is reversed. But Leeds,
I could be wrong.
And the facts of Leeds don't involve the way the facts in Caputo did, where this court recognized a cause of action under the UFL. In Caputo, there were many, many checks over a period of a year. And based upon the facts of that case, the number of transactions, the nature of the customer, what the bank knew. Okay, in Caputo, apparently the people at the bank were aware that, unfortunately, Mr. Caputo had an issue with gambling.
So this is a dentist's office, and I want to see if I understand your view of the scope of the statute, following up on Justice Solomon's question.
Okay.
Two dozen patients come that day for dental services. They pay a copay where they pay for the services altogether, and then at the end of the day, a deposit is prepared with 24 different checks. Dental hygienist goes to the bank, forges all of them. The first check, there's no liability under the Act because she's not yet a fiduciary, as you've described it for us. But the second through the 24th check, maybe, because of the theory of constructive trust, she's become a fiduciary and breached her fiduciary obligation. Is that how you would see this case unfolding?
No. Close. But my view is that she became, or they became, fiduciaries after the first check.
Even though they're the forgers.
That's what I said. Your first check,
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
But the second copay, you have a potential UFL action as you read the statute.
Based upon the, right, it's a jury question to decide whether, and again, for all we know in this case, because we didn't get the opportunity to conduct discovery, we're talking about the jury question, and at what point should the bank have known?
So there's something I have to, from my perspective, there's something very surreal about this argument, and I'll tell you why. Because we know that for a forged check, there's strict liability. Number one check, number two check, number three check. All the checks, okay, you could have just filed the UCC claim. 3 years, okay? 3 years where those checks are coming back to the dentist or his accountant, where someone should know that hundreds of thousands of dollars are being misappropriated. And within 3 years under the UCC, which is the most direct claim, nothing filed. And here we are now, under some other theory that we're supposed to believe where the UCC hasn't occupied the field. We're trying to come up with, you know, on the 10th check or the 12th or the 50th, they're supposed to, they should know that something's off. Okay. Are you following me?
I am. But I disagree. First, the check wouldn't be returned to Dr. Lembo. The check that was forged would be returned to the insurance company and show that it was paid. Secondly, if there were discovery in this case, there is software that not only Dr. Lembo but most dentists have, which track the payment of status of insurance claims and ultimate insurance payments. What Dr. Lembo relied upon was his software, which was his guideline to what checks were being paid by insurance companies. These facts put Dr. Lembo into foreclosure. And ultimately, he did not find out about it and file his claim within the 3 years. That is very unfortunate, because it would have been a lot easier for everyone involved. Most importantly, Dr. Lembo, who again experienced extreme financial hardship as a result of this. But we are where we are in the case, and a UCC claim wasn't possible. Okay, so simply because he didn't file in time doesn't preclude this action. Okay, and we have to remember that we've been speaking a lot about, well, when does liability arise? And is it after 1? Is it after 6? Okay? Is it after 20? This court stated that's for the jury to decide. So, number one. But number two, that's all the second prong of this analysis, whether there was bad faith. Okay? There could also be direct knowledge by the bank that Ms. Wright or Ms. Marchese was showing up with a forged check. Okay? That's the first prong of this. And unfortunately, we have no idea not only what the teller knew or didn't know, we have no idea who the teller was. Okay? And whether or not they were familiar with Ms. Marchese or Ms. Wright, were in on this scheme.
So no. How about the argument of your opponent that for non-customer claims you have to show a special relationship?
That would be for a common law conversion claim. The special relationship is not required for a UFL claim.
And why is that?
The statute doesn't require it.
That's assuming that it gives rise to a separate cause of action, of course.
Granted. Okay. But again, I think that if it didn't give rise to a separate cause of action...
If it doesn't, do you still have a claim? Arguendo.
Our claim is based upon the UFL, so to the extent that the UFL doesn't provide for such a claim, we wouldn't have a claim.
Okay, so you're rising and fall on
the UFL.
Okay.
And that rises and falls on whether these are fiduciaries. You don't get to what the bank knew if they... We're not dealing with fiduciaries, correct?
That is true. Yeah. So at the end of the day, it all boils down to, were Marchese and Wright fiduciaries? If so, did the bank have actual knowledge, or were there facts to suggest bad faith?
I think we understand your position. Anything else you'd
Thank
like
you.
To
No, that's
wrap
it.
Up?
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Shattuck, did you want to offer a rebuttal?
I'll be very brief, just to clear up any issue and just hit home my point that I think the Chief just spoke about, is the UCC is what provides a remedy here. It would have provided a remedy. There was a 3-year statute of limitations. The discovery rule does not apply. The court has already said that. And the reason for the 3-year statute is to bring finality and predictability to banks. So now, if we were to permit a UFL claim that has no statute of limitations, banks would be subjected to claims, limitless claims, for we don't know how long. But the UFL does not apply here. Caputo, which counsel keeps harping on, the issue there was whether there was bad faith. The UFL potentially applied there because they were fiduciaries. There is no fiduciary relationship here. And because Justice Solomon asked, I took a look back at the complaint, and I'll just read to you the allegation, which is, Marchese and Wright conspired and engaged in a scheme whereby Marchese and Wright unlawfully took possession and control of numerous checks and unlawfully forged Dr. Lembo's signature without his knowledge, authorization, or consent. There is no getting around that allegation. They had no authority. They could not be fiduciaries. And in Leeds, the court, citing to Salzman, says, in not allowing the UFL to apply, they say, to exonerate a bank under the UFL, it must be shown that the attorney came into possession of the funds as a fiduciary. Since he had no right to the funds, was not a fiduciary of the payee, and was not authorized to endorse checks on his behalf, the bank cannot claim protection of the statute. And the Leeds court later states that Chase's liability to Leeds is not for the bank's failure to inquire into the attorney's breach of his obligation of fiduciary. It is for accepting a forged altered check for deposit, irrespective of the circumstance that the forger was also a fiduciary with respect to his clients. Chase cannot avail itself of the protections of the UFL because Chase's liability here arises out of its payment on an altered check conversion under the UCC and not under the attorney's subsequent disposition of the proceeds of that check. So that's the point here. The liability on TD Bank would have been for taking a check with a forged endorsement, whether it was 1, 2, 27, 4,000, that's conversion under the UCC. Not what did Wright and Marchese do with these checks. The bank did not have to look into that. So if a bank cannot use the UFL to shield itself from liability, a statute intended to protect banks, how can this court permit an affirmative cause of action outside the UCC with no special relationship and now put the onus on a bank to have to undertake, after one check, 27 checks, 52 checks, all of that goes to bad faith. But the point here is the statute does not apply. They were not fiduciaries.
Let me just say it another way, but I think it's what you're saying. If they had brought a timely UCC claim, Lead says the bank could not use the UFL as a defense because they took a forged instrument. And because the instrument was forged by the depositor who had an account there, they cannot be a fiduciary.
Yes, Your Honor. They could not use the UFL to protect
as a defense.
Them. But now the statute's been blown, but counsel would want his client to be able to bring a claim.
But I'm just saying, Leeds was a UCC
yes.
claim.
And the bank
and the court
was strictly
was saying,
liability.
You cannot use the UFL as a defense because under this forged fact pattern, even though the attorney's a trustee and a fiduciary at the beginning, you can't use the UFL as a defense. Here we have no fiduciary at the inception. We do have a forged instrument deposited by a bank, but no affirmative UCC claim.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'll use your great summary of the case to conclude my argument.
I didn't think it was that
great,
but okay.
Thank you, counsel. I'll take the matter under advisement. Court's going to take a brief recess. We'll be